From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, oh yes, those open lines. Here's what's happening, and we are going to begin the program tonight asking you for some help. Our very special Coast to Coast guest, Danyon Brinkley, needs your prayers tonight. He's in the hospital, and he is asking that our Coast audience pray for him to give him enough strength to fight and triumph over death one more time. As you know, he has been at death's door several times. We'll update you as soon as we can about his situation. But Danyon Brinkley and his family asking for prayers tonight. Hackers appear to have compromised and published private messages from at least 81,000 Facebook users' accounts. The perpetrators said that they had details from a total of 120 million accounts, which they are attempting to sell, although there are reasons to be skeptical about that high figure. Nonetheless, I think there was a big hack there. Imagine an insect that can align along a pipeline to sniff out a gas leak or swoop beneath plants to detect pests and disease. Well, they have made the first wireless insect-sized robot that has taken flight. It is an amazing piece of equipment. It's just incredible what they're doing with this kind of technology. The U.S. economy added 250,000 jobs in October, significantly exceeding expectations. That, according to the government. Let's check in with consulting expert Charles Kappas. Chuck, what did you expect on something like this? Did you think that would happen?
Well, the jobs report was pretty much on target, but it's, you know, there's the U6 unemployment figures and so on that indicate about 8 or 10% unemployment. We also talk about the stock market a lot, which I think that's a false metric for our economy overall, George, because in October, as I sort of predicted, the NASDAQ had the worst losses since 2008. And S&P 500 since, you know, 2011. $2 trillion in wealth effect wiped out. This is an election year, so they're going to really hype up the economy, as you could expect. But they've been pretty much doing this since 2009 with the plunge protection team to create a bubble economy, pretty much what we have by Fed intervention and so on. I think investors need to be very cautious going forward. And, George, the real concern, I think, going forward in our economy, our unsustainable debt on every level.
This week,
John Bolton said our national debt is a national security issue, and that's correct. I think that's a very serious issue. That's why I wrote my book, America's Financial Reckoning Day. I think we're facing a reckoning day in this economy. It's a bubble economy, and I don't really trust a lot of government figures that they put out there. So I think people should be very cautious going forward.
Okay, thank you, Chuck. Appreciate it. And, you know, a couple more months, we're going into 2019 with our fingers crossed. Biblical prophecy comes true as a live snake wiggles its way out of Israel's Western Wall. People visiting the famous wall this week filmed the serpent wiggling out from between the ancient stones. In the video, the snake can be seen coming out of the wall after scaring off a pigeon that had been perched there. It reportedly is a sign of the return of the Messiah. But what's so important about that is the Jewish mysticism explains that the evil inclination personified by the snake in Eden will make a resurgence in the days before the Messiah. And that, of course, means the beginning of end of days. So we shall see what's happening. What else is happening in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hi, Peter.
Good evening, George. And boy, what a week it's been. But there's nothing more important than wishing Danyon Brinkley well wishes and Godspeed. I look forward to hearing the news that he's back on his feet and doing well. We're at close to the 100th anniversary of the signing of the armistice in 1918, and I thought I'd like to start my report tonight with a very interesting report I've received from a gentleman in France. This is an excerpt from a book entitled An Awakening, The Arab Campaign, 1917 to 1918, Chapter 5, The Regulars. The author, Sir Alec Kirkbride, who was a young lieutenant in the British Army at the time, writes that on the evening or the night of the 12th of June, 1918, he saw an incandescent globe, he calls it, come out from behind a range of mountains, illuminate the valley that he was in very brightly for approximately 30 seconds before it passed behind another range of mountains and disappeared. He wrote it. He was so struck by it that he included it in his book. It's a very interesting account of what he saw over 100 years ago.
Jeez.
Second report is a little more recent. Comes from, of all places, Everett, George, where we're going to be in March of next year.
March 23rd. Looking forward to it.
Gentlemen, on the morning of the 19th of October at 2:51 in the morning, he says he was admiring the North Star and the Big Dipper when all of a sudden he saw two triangular craft, unlighted, just streak overhead. He estimates he saw it for less than 1 second, but he saw it well enough to get a good image in his mind's eye of what they looked like. 2.5 hours later, Exira, Iowa, a woman saw, she writes in her report, a rectangular plate-shaped, disc-shaped object. She's a little vague on its shape, but it was silver in color and had six red lights around its periphery and four white lights. Her description is very involved, and we'll have that posted to our website sometime over the weekend. Exira, Iowa, very interesting report. And on the 23rd of October, 2:18 in the morning, Pacific time, a woman writes she was outside admiring the night sky, and she saw a reddish-yellow ball of light move to the west, execute a U-turn, and suddenly point up, and it accelerated dramatically, she writes. The last report I'd like to share comes from Prescott, Arkansas, tonight. A trucker saw a very bright diamond-shaped object that streaked down out of the sky, he describes, executed a turn, streaked a short distance, executed another turn, and disappeared from his sight at about 9:45 tonight in Prescott, Arkansas. Anyway, it's been a busy week, George, and wish you a good weekend.
You too, Pete. We'll talk to you next weekend. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, we'll talk about the weirdest movie ever made. What is it? Stick around and find out when we come right back with Phil Hall. And welcome back to Coast, Phil Hall with us. Let me tell you a little bit about Phil. He's an author of many books, including The History of Independent Cinema, The Greatest Bad Movies of All Time, and In Search of Lost Films, and also The Weirdest Movie Ever Made. He's the host of the SoundCloud podcast, the online movie show with Phil Hall, and his film writing has been published in the New York Times, New York Daily News, and Wired. He's also authoring the weekly column, The Bootleg Files, on the Cinema Crazed website. Phil Hall here on Coast to Coast. Phil, looking forward to talking about this new book and all the things you've been doing. Welcome to the show.
Hello, George. Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, how did you, an expert in cinema, stumble across the weirdest movie ever made, and that's the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film?
Well, there's a bit of a complicated story. I have my books published through a company called Bear Manna Media, and I just had published a book, In Search of Lost Films, which came out in 2016. And I was trying to think of something to come up as an encore for a new book. And I went to my publisher and I said, I have this great idea for a book. It's going to be called 100 Movies That Changed the World. And it was basically, it would be 100 essays of films that made significant contributions to culture, politics, technology, etc. And my publisher said, that's a terrible idea. He said, go back and just pick one movie and write about it. And I went back to the list and I looked over the list and I realized my publisher was right, because a lot of the movies that were on the list had been written about to death. We don't really need another book about Citizen Kane or Gone with the Wind or The Godfather. But on the list was the Patterson-Gimlin film. And I thought, you know, I've never seen a book about the Patterson-Gimlin film from a cinematic appreciation angle. There are a lot of books about Bigfoot, and of course the Patterson-Gimlin film plays into that, but there's never been one that looks at this little 59 seconds of film as a work of cinema. And I went back to my publisher and I said, what do you think? And he said, go for it. And The book came out last month on October 1st, and it's available now on Amazon and all the book e-commerce sites.
And how did you get the title, The Weirdest Movie Ever Made?
I was trying to think of something that would make the book stand out, because in many ways the title is about one half of the book, because if the title can grab you, that's going to be a great seller. But looking at the Patterson Gimlin film, it is the weirdest film ever made when you stop and think about it, because you're looking at it as like, what is this thing? Is this real? Is this fake? How did these two guys with no experience in filmmaking whatsoever wind up in the right place at the right time? And how did they wind up just being there with this this thing on camera? The whole story is so odd. And then I started researching the book, and the story got weirder and weirder as I delved into it, and the only word I could really think of was weird to describe this, and that's where it became the weirdest movie ever made.
Let's talk about the film, if you can, for us, Phil. It happened on October 20th, 1967. Kind of brief us on just what happened.
What happened, there were two fellows from Washington State named Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin. Roger Patterson was obsessed with the concept of Sasquatches, and he had received a tip that there were Sasquatch prints in Northern California outside of the city of Humboldt. Bob Gimlin was a friend of his. They had both been rodeo riders at one time. They had both served in the military. Neither of them had any experience in filmmaking, but they decided they would go down to California and see if they could film a Sasquatch in the wild. And they had a 16-millimeter camera, which actually turned out Roger Patterson leased it from a camera store in his town and didn't bring it back, so it was a stolen camera. And they went to this area in Northern California looking for the Sasquatch, which was something nobody had ever filmed before. They went deep into the woods. It was so far in they couldn't bring their automobiles. They had to take pack horses to ride in. And lo and behold, at a sandbar, which is known as Bluff Creek, they said they saw something which had never been seen before and had never been captured on camera. Roger Patterson was on his horse when they saw the Sasquatch, which is why the first part of the footage is very shaky, because Roger was trying to get off his horse. The horse was apparently scared while he was still holding the camera. He injured his ankle in doing so, but he maintained a good grasp on the camera and was able to film the Sasquatch walking off into the woods. Apparently, it was didn't really want to interact with these two guys, but it made its casual way out of the scene. It didn't seem to be agitated, except at one point it just turned around to look at them. In doing so, its arms spread unusually wide, mm-hmm. which is one of the most famous frames from the film, and then walked off. Roger and Bob had some plaster with them, so they were able to make plaster casts of the footprints of this Sasquatch. And they went back to Humboldt with their film and with their plaster casts, and the rest, as the cliche goes, is history.
I've looked at this film several times, Phil, and that scene that you depict that's on the cover of your book is a really strange, weird-looking frame, isn't it?
It is, and what's weird about it is the creature, for lack of a better word, is out of shape. It's out of proportion. It doesn't look like a regular animal. Animals are beautiful creations of symmetry, and this thing is not symmetrical at all. The legs are unusually thick and muscular. The arms are far too long to go with that body. From the forehead up, it sort of looks like a gorilla, but it's walking like a human, though slightly hunched over. And when it turns around to look, unfortunately the film is so shaky and blurry, you don't get a clear picture. But there seems to be a human-ish face, not a human face, looking back at you. And it's just, when you see this thing, it's like, what is this? And is this a guy in a costume, or was this actually a Sasquatch, which had been part of Native American folklore since the beginning of civilization?
There have been rumors that Gimlin might have been in the suit, if there was one, while Patterson was taking the film of him walking around. Have you heard that as you were writing the book?
I never heard that, and that doesn't seem very logical, because both Patterson and Gimlin were rather short people. The Sasquatch is a fairly tall thing, and Gimlin is not a tall person. So if he was in the suit, he'd have to be wearing elevator shoes.
Prior to the movie and the film and your book, what did you think about all these Bigfoot stories that have been coming down?
You know, writing the book was a lot of fun because I was a little kid in the 1970s. And back then, you couldn't turn on the TV or go to the movies or open a magazine without seeing something related to Bigfoot or some sort of paranormal or cryptozoology phenomenon. And it brought back a lot of very happy memories for me because this is something which was part of the pop culture of my youth. And I always, at the time, as a kid, I always assumed, oh, well, Bigfoot's out there because it's on TV, it has to be real. And going into this, I never really knew the story behind Bigfoot. And that was actually the most fun I had, is trying to figure out just when did Bigfoot come into popular culture? Because for me and people of my generation, it was always there. But there had to be a time when Bigfoot actually made its debut in front of the American public and then later, of course, the world public.
Who was William Rowe and what was his role with any of this?
Now, William Rowe was an interesting person because he was a construction worker in British Columbia, and in the late 1950s, he said that he saw a female Sasquatch in the woods when he was out on a job. And he described the female Sasquatch as having furry, floppy breasts. And this is important because when you look at the Patterson-Gimlin film, when Bigfoot turns around to look at the camera, Bigfoot has furry, floppy breasts. Now, if this was a man in a gorilla suit, that would have been a little strange because back then, if you wanted to buy a gorilla costume like they would have in the Three Stooges movies or the Bowery Boys movies, it was a male gorilla. They didn't have breasts.
Right.
But here
right.
You have a female gorilla with breasts, with fur-covered breasts, as William Rowe described it. Now, a lot of anthropologists said that Bigfoot was fake because if this was supposed to be a primate, primates do not have fur on their breasts. The female primates don't, whereas Bigfoot does. But then that also raises the question, well, then maybe Bigfoot is not a primate, or if it is, it's a subspecies and is genetically different from the primates we would assume either in Africa or the orangutan in Asia.
Even though the title is the weirdest movie ever made, what did you think of the movie itself?
You know, I could watch this thing over and over, and in fact, I have. Well,
it's 59 solid seconds, right?
59 seconds, and you just can't get enough of this because, and that's the beauty of it, because it's a blink of an eye type of a situation. If this was a 10-minute film or a 15-minute or even a 2-minute film, it would wear out its welcome, but it happens so quickly. And really, half of the 59 seconds is blurry and shaky while Roger Patterson's trying to steady himself, or so he said. And there you see Bigfoot just walking away with that brief glimpse backwards. It's really beautifully shot, and it really adds to the mystery of it, because if it was a clear picture of Bigfoot, or if Bigfoot was walking to the camera, or if it was a longer chase through the woods, it would not have had the same effect. This happens just so quickly. It's like, oh, my God, did I really see what I think I saw?
I'm sure, Phil, that the frame has been analyzed and blown up and everything else by experts. Has anybody said anything about that?
Oh, everybody has an opinion on that. There are people who have studied this film religiously. They've had motion stabilization software, so they take the shake out of the film so we could see what Bigfoot would look like if the camera wasn't shaking. They've measured it with computers. Half of the opinion is it's completely impossible for this to have been duplicated by a man in a suit. And the other half of the opinion is it's a man in a suit. So it's a polarizing film, too. That's the beauty of it, too. You can't be indifferent to it. To quote George W. Bush, either you're with us or against us. And that's the story with Bigfoot. Either you're with us and believe that this is a real creature, or you say you're fake. In that case, then you're against those who are advocating for the Sasquatch.
Stay with us. Phil Hall is our special guest. We're going to take calls with Phil next hour, but I've got more questions for him when we come back as we talk about the weirdest movie ever made, the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film, which was filmed in October of 1967. But when did the public get a chance to see it? So we'll talk with Phil about that. And then later on, we'll talk about one of his other books, The Greatest Bad Movies of All Time. I've got a few of them I want to throw his way when we come back to. We will take your calls next hour with Phil Hall as we talk about the weirdest movie ever made, the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film, but we'll also talk with him about other movies, so get ready to make the call next hour here on Coast to Coast. Hey, our editor, of course, for Coast to Coast and our website is Tim Banal, who selects some amazing stories under the feature In Coast You Missed It. Pretty clever, Tim. Who came up with that?
That was actually my idea, George. Take credit for that. Hey, I just want to say I'm coming at you tonight from the home of the world champion Boston Red Sox here in Boston, Mass.
I love it. Love Boston. Used to go up there as a kid. My mother was born in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, Tim. So we got up there every summer, and Red Sox, great team. They did a great job. It was a great series.
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
Anyways, what do you got for us this week?
Well, we got a great story up on the website. It's in the number one slot. And it's kind of akin in sort of what we do here at Coast to Coast. This law enforcement website has a lot of police officers, you know, who populate news and stuff like that.
Yep.
They put a call out for police officers who had paranormal experiences. And they got a whole bunch back, and we picked out some of the best ones in our article here on the Coast website in the number one slot. Want to mention, of course, the In Coast You Miss It is in number two. Two stories stood out. One quick one, which I think you'll really enjoy the delicious irony of this. The police officer in South Carolina, he writes in, story says, while I'm on the job working the overnight, I love to listen to Coast AM. And I heard Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center talking about the latest cases, you know, that had crossed his desk. Later on that night, the police officer has his own UFO sighting, and he reports it back to Peter Davenport.
Synchronicity at its best.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty wild, you know. It's sort of like it just perpetuates itself. It's great. The other story is the one that really knocked my socks off. This comes from a police officer in Maine. This woman had been missing for 3 days, and he's out at night. He's driving around. He sees her. She's curled up in a ball on the side of the road.
Wow.
He gets her, you know. He gets out, goes up to her, and he says, "Where have you been?" She's really angry. She says, "The spaceman took me." Oh. And she's all, you know, frazzled. And she's like, "Can you take me to the hospital? My stomach hurts because they made me eat this green stuff and did, you know, gave me a medical examination." So as they're driving, she's talking about this experience, and she's sharing all kinds of details about it. And the thing that really knocked my socks off, really just blew my mind, she says, gave me chills. She says, on the ship, where it was full of missing people who had been taken from Earth, and they're not going back. So that was pretty
creepy. That's chilling.
Yeah, yeah. Can you imagine? So they get to the hospital, and the police officer's like, "Listen, you know, this is a really amazing story. Do you have anything that you can do to, like, prove this? Do you have any evidence?" And to the astonishment of the doctors and the police officer, she reaches into her pocket and pulls out a smooth, black, oval-shaped rock, which the officer described as iridescent. And she gave it to him. He's holding it. He turns it in his hand. He says, when it moved back and forth and side to side, it would have the colors of gasoline in a mud puddle.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's
and
shimmering.
So after they had all looked at it in amazement, she snatched it back, and she's like, "This is mine. I took it because the aliens rejected me because they didn't want to keep me, and they dropped me off on the side of the road. So this is my revenge. I took the rock from them."
That's a cool story.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty amazing. And just sort of a last coda, the cop says later in life, he retired, opened up a jewelry store, and they had rocks from all over the world there, and he said he's never seen anything like the rock that he saw that night.
That one came from out of this world. Tim, thanks. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, George. Have a great weekend.
Tim Banal, our editor for CoastToCoastAM.com, works with Sean and Lex all the time, coming up with these great stories that you can find at CoastToCoastAM.com. We are back with Phil Hall, the weirdest movie ever made. This movie was made in October 1967. Phil, when did people get a chance to see it?
Well, people started to see the film drip by drip. It's kind of strange to consider that in today's viral video age. But back then, this was shot on 16mm film, so it had to be processed, and prints had to be made, and they had to be physically delivered. The first screening came about a week after the film was shot. It was at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Patterson and Gimlin, along with several like-minded friends of theirs, were able to arrange a screening for the scientists at the university, and they were the first people to see the film, and they weren't very impressed with it. In fact, they said it was a fake. Patterson came back to Yakima, Washington, where he lived, and a local TV station there, KIMA, did a news segment on it and showed a bit of the film. So that was the first time Bigfoot was on television. Patterson and Gimlin were contacted by Life magazine in November of 1967, and they flew to New York with the film. Life magazine was interested in running pictures from the film, but they wanted to have it checked out first, and they arranged for a screening with scientists from the American Museum of Natural History and the Bronx Zoo. And the scientists all said the film was a fake, and Life magazine decided not to run the pictures. But there was another magazine at that time called Argosy magazine.
Right.
And they ran the pictures, and it was February of 1968, and that was the first time people saw that famous frame where Bigfoot is looking at the camera with its arms wide open, and that was the first time people saw the imagery from the film. Now, what was interesting is that Roger Patterson was trying to interest as many media outlets as possible to write about the film and to run pictures and maybe also show it for a broadcast, and it was running into a wall. Nobody was really interested because we're already into 1968, and there was a lot going on that year, and you could understand why that somehow got lost in the news cycle.
Sure.
And then a miracle happened. Roger Patterson got contacted by the British Broadcasting Corporation.
The BBC. Okay.
And they wanted to show the film on BBC in England. Apparently, I guess they may have learned about it from the Canadian press, which covered the news when they were up in Vancouver. There were some news articles, but they didn't run any photos. But there was a bit of a quandary because BBC didn't really have the money that Roger Patterson was insisting that they pay him for the film. So they came up with a compromise. They would run the film in a short documentary on BBC and give Roger Patterson the print of the film, which he could show theatrically in the United States but not broadcast on television. So more people in England actually saw Bigfoot before the United States, which is kind of funny. But Patterson took the film back from the BBC, and he shot some new footage of him riding a horse around Washington State and talking with his friends about looking for Sasquatches. And he created a documentary film, which he took to theaters in the Pacific Northwest on a platform release, which means he went town by town, going theater by theater. And when there were no theaters, they rented high school auditoriums and VFW halls, and they showed the film. And this is how America started to see Bigfoot and the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Did they go wild when they saw it, the public?
Yes, they did. The film was a huge, huge success. Patterson was there at the screenings, and he recounted what had happened at Bluff Creek. Bob Gimlin was not part of that. Bob was not as much of a showman as Roger was, and so he did not do the tour, and later on there were some financial problems because Roger didn't give him the correct percentage of profits from the film's release. But people loved it. And one reason they loved it, too, is because he was coming into these small towns in the Northwest and then in the Midwest with this original film. This was not a Hollywood movie. This was something that nobody had seen before. And a lot of people in the Northwest particularly were familiar with the Sasquatch legend. So this is something that they already knew, and reaction was extraordinary.
Now, you talked about the split between Patterson and Gimlin. Was it over money? What happened?
It was over, yes, unfortunately, it was over money. Patterson was the brains of the operation in terms of business. He wasn't the most honest brains of it, and There's no nice way of putting it. He sort of chiseled Gimlin out of the prophets, and this created a schism between the two. Gimlin was also harassed in his hometown by people who thought the Bigfoot was a fake, and they would drive by his house and yell insults. They even insulted his wife. She worked as a teller at a savings and loan. And he had expressed regret that he was ever involved in this thing. Roger Patterson had passed away in 1972, and Patterson and Gimlin were able to reconcile before Roger's death. So personally, their union ended on a good note. Professionally, did not. Bob Gimlin had to sue Patterson's widow to get the money that was owed to him.
You talk about a tie-in between the Patterson-Gimlin film and the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination, which was shot 4 years prior.
That's correct. When you think about it, they're sort of the same, the different sides of the same coin. They're both amateur films. They're both grainy, shaky, silent color films. The Zapruder film was shot in 8mm. Patterson-Gimlin film was in 16mm. And both of them are seeing something which the public should not have been seeing, and the most extraordinary imagery. The Zapruder film, of course, was a full-color view of President Kennedy being murdered. And that film has been dissected to death years and years, for 55 years now. And the same thing with the Patterson-Gimlin film. It's been dissected to death over the years. It's been debated. And these two films continue to fascinate us today. There are still books being written about the films. Obviously, Patterson-Gimlin, my book. But there are conferences and web discussions and articles about the impact that these two films made. And actually, the Zapruder film would have been one of the 100 films that I had in my original book proposal. But again, that film's been written about to death, so that's why I decided to go with the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Well, and you've done a great job. I want to talk with you about some of your other books in a second, Phil, but it's so fascinating what has been going on with the Bigfoot phenomenon. I mean, so many people are witnessing so many things. Nobody, and they're not lying. They're seeing something. What do you think they're looking at?
I don't know. And I sort of get upset when people hear about these sightings and say, oh, they're just a bunch of kooks. No, you're obviously hearing and seeing something, whether it's a bear, whether it's a cougar, or whether it is a creature that has not been classified yet by science. We don't know. I'm not there with these people, so I have no idea what they're seeing, what they're hearing, and for that matter, what state of mind they're in when they're actually outside with these encounters. I respect people who say that they have encountered a Sasquatch, or they may have heard or seen something that could be a Sasquatch. I think it's rude to dismiss people as being ridiculous, because unless you're there with them, you have absolutely no idea what they're seeing and hearing.
Did you hire some experts or scientists to look at the film?
I didn't, no, but the film had been studied by a lot of scientists over the year. There was a fellow out of Canada, René Dehindim, who sort of made his life trying to get the scientific community to accept the Patterson-Gimlin film as genuine. And he had passed away, and he had, towards the end of his life, he had complained that he had never actually seen a Sasquatch himself, and was always upset about the fact that here he spent his life trying to convince people that this creature existed where he never had firsthand experience with it.
Bob Hieronymus, for years, says this is a fake. And he's gotten some people, of course, to accept that. What do you think?
Bob Hieronymus was an acquaintance of Patterson and Gimlin from Washington State. His story is that he was the man in the suit, and he was down at Bluff Creek with them. There are a couple of problems with the story. One, there's no physical evidence that he was the man in the suit. There's no photo of him.
Right. No polygraph test.
No polygraph test that I'm aware of. Also, Patterson and Gimlin were spotted in Humboldt, California, in October 1967. Hieronymus was not. And it didn't seem very likely, if they were to go down there, that Hieronymus would go in a separate car and then leave. I mean, if these three guys were pulling a hoax, it would make sense that the three of them would have gone together.
Well, that's a good point. How do people get a chance to read the book, The Weirdest Movie Ever Made?
Well, they can go on Amazon and look for The Weirdest Movie Ever Made, Patterson-Gimlin, Bigfoot film. It's on BarnesandNoble.com. My publisher, Bear Manna Media, it's on its website. If anybody's listening to us in the United Kingdom, W.H. Smith and Company has it on their website, too. It's not difficult to find.
Do people still look at this film for the first time, and are they wowed, Phil?
Oh, yes, because we have a film that's in release now called Smallfoot, which is an animated film about the Yeti, which is the Himalayan version of Bigfoot. It used to be called The Abominable Snowman.
That's
so
right.
Here we have a new generation of kids who will be going to the theaters with their parents, and they'll be seeing Yetis on the screen. And if these kids are clever and they want to learn more about the subject, I'm sure that they'll just go on the internet and do some search, and they'll find the Yeti has an American cousin in the Pacific Northwest.
I was always fascinated with the stories of the Abominable Snowman, and I remember at a very young age coming home to tell my parents about it. I didn't say Yeti, I said the Abominable Snowman, and they're looking at me, spit this word out, and they're saying, George, how do you pronounce that? How did you know that? And it was probably one of the most difficult words to pronounce, but I hit that one.
Well, you know, the word abominable doesn't really turn up in everyday vocabulary.
No.
In conjunction with snowman.
It's a fascinating story about what's going on. We don't hear too much about the Abominable Snowman / Yeti anymore. How come?
I don't know. I mean, well, there's the new movie that came out, Smallfoot, so I assume that might
spark it again.
New interest in it. Maybe because Bigfoot is an American phenomenon, whereas the Yeti is over in Asia. People may have given up searching for the Yeti, or there aren't that many sightings. I have no idea why its popularity would have fallen. Though there have been a ton of movies made over the past 5 or 6 years regarding this type of a creature. Most of them are related to Bigfoot or the Sasquatch, but there have been a number of Yeti films that have been made independently.
And there are a number of films that are continue to be made. Do you think Hollywood does a good job with production?
Well, Hollywood's a bit strange with Bigfoot because, as I mentioned earlier, the creature in the Patterson-Gimlin film appears to be a female and is indifferent to the human interaction, is actually walking away from the camera.
Right.
The Hollywood movies about Bigfoot, Bigfoot tends to be a male, tends to be very hostile, has no problems interacting in a violent way with humans, and in a lot of films, Bigfoot seems to be attracted to attractive human females, which is, I don't know where that came from, but I guess that sold tickets at the box office.
Or it didn't, one way or another.
Well, it was just funny because the second Hollywood film made about Bigfoot was in 1971. It was called The Geek, and it was actually an X-rated movie. So people had a bit of a fervid imagination from the very beginning about this.
In reality, we do not get many stories of Bigfoot attacks on human beings. We don't get those.
No, not contemporary attacks. There had been a very famous story from the 1920s about a group of people in a cabin who were supposedly attacked with rocks and stones. It was the Ape Canyon attack.
They were throwing them at the building, right?
That's correct, yes. But nobody was killed. And that is, as far as I know, is really the only major story where there is something. Theodore Roosevelt had written in one of his books about, it was a story about somebody who had been out in the woods in the 1880s or 1890s, who was supposedly killed by an unknown creature. He didn't specifically say it was a Sasquatch, but he gave the impression that this was not a creature that was known to mankind at the time.
Right. It could have been a bear. We're going to come back, Phil. We'll talk about the greatest bad movies of all time. I want to tell you about the one I saw, and then we'll take phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM.